We finished the third century, and we're about to start the fourth. And so our Roman numeral 5 is the church in the fourth century, and under that I'm going to make a general remarks. We have noticed in the first century how little we know about the history of the church aside from what's in the New Testament. We have a great deal there about the early days of the church. But aside from that, we know nothing of the activities of the other apostles. There are traditions, most of which began a long time afterwards. We know practically nothing about the church in the first century except for just the little we have about the persecution under Nero. We see, however, the results of the first century in the situation in the second century where the church was, Christianity was considered illegal. And this was the attitude of the Roman state. But in the second century, we know really comparatively little about the history of Christianity until we get to the end of the century when we have those long writings of Irenaeus and of Tertullian. And those don't give us much history. They are discussion of various matters and only incidentally a little history. But we see how greatly the number of Christians has increased by that time. Then when we come to the third century, we have considerable more information than in the second century. But even then, our information is really very limited about the church. And we notice how the last two-fifths of the third century, Christianity was permitted. It was legal. They could hold property. They could build churches. They had 40 years of entire freedom from persecution, and the church was growing rapidly in number during those years. But we do not have many outstanding men during that period. And our information about these first three centuries rests to a very great extent on people being important enough that later ones thought their writings worth copying. And then other people copying them and so on, so that they would be preserved to us for this day. Out of the number of bishops of Rome that you had in those three centuries, there must have been many letters that they wrote to various people about various matters. They were the administrative heads of the largest of the church in the capital city of the empire. There were connections all over the empire. There must have been all sorts of matters that bishops of Rome had to correspond about. People going from their churches to other churches, coming to their church from other parts of the empire, various problems, discussions. They must have written money letters. But practically none of them were thought important enough for anybody to copy and try to preserve. So we have practically no letters from any bishop of Rome during those three centuries. It is only when you have a man of the great genius and ability of Cyprian, that his letters were copied and recopied and preserved. And we have dozens of letters from Cyprian on many different subjects. But now we get into an entirely different situation. After 325, let us say, after the first fourth, approximately, of the fourth century, we get into a period in which Christianity is moving forward rapidly. A period in which it has many prominent leaders, and there are many vital points of discussion, of controversy, and of activity. And the result is that we know far more about the years from 325 to 460, a period of less than a century and a half. We know far more about that period than we do, aside from the New Testament, about all of Christian history before that time, and all of it for the next 600 or 700 years put together. We have a period of 125 years here, which is a period from which a tremendous amount of material is preserved, and in which there were a great many very able men. Almost anybody of any ability in these first three centuries that we know anything about, we've stopped to look at. We couldn't possibly do that for the next century and a quarter. If we did, we would spend all the rest of the year on it. All we can do is to take the most important characters and the most important events during that tremendous period of a century and a quarter. And then after that century and a quarter, it's almost as if a dark curtain comes down over the world. It's really amazingly sudden how it happens. Here is the second volume of Schoff's History of the Christian Church. This is volume 2, from AD 100 to 325. Volume 3 is a little larger than this one, and he calls it AD 300 to 600. That is, supposedly, it covers 300 years, this next volume, which is slightly larger than this. But in that volume, at least four-fifths of the material deals with the first half of that period. The period from 450 to 600, we have almost less information about than we had about the third century. Almost like a curtain just coming down over the world is the darkness that flooded across at the end of the ancient world. Right at just about, it was occurring between 400 and 500. But our Christian history goes in full light up till nearly 460, and then suddenly we're in just about complete darkness. It's one of the most amazing things you can imagine, how we have nearly 1,000 years of which we, which is so utterly different, a period almost of savagery compared with the great civilization of the preceding time. And in that great period of Roman civilization, the last century and a quarter was the time when the Christian church was tremendously active and had a great many very important people in it and a great many very important events. Before we get to that great century and a quarter, though, we have the first quarter of a century to look at. And that was a period different from any before or from any since, except perhaps part of the Reformation period. So we take then capital B, the persecution of Diocletian. The persecution of Diocletian. We've already noticed that Diocletian was a great administrator, a man who had taken an empire that was beginning to fall into a very difficult situation as a result of the frequent changes of emperorship and the military control that had been shifting so rapidly during a period of nearly a century. And during this time, the pressure of the outside world, the uncivilized or uncultivated world outside, had been getting greater. You remember Decius was killed in 250 fighting against the Goths, the people on the border of the empire. And time and again, they had great battles on the border of the empire to protect it from the coming in of these great numbers of people that had none of the Roman education. These people seemed to, it is usually thought, that they were pressed from behind by other people, less civilized than they, but great, more numerous, pushing against them and causing them to move in the direction of the Roman Empire. I don't know how much proof there is of that. It's largely conjectural, but it certainly is a fact that there was this pressure against the northern borders of the Roman Empire, constantly pressing against it and taking a great deal of effort, a great deal of taxation, a great many men constantly watching and fighting in order to protect the borders of the Roman Empire. I don't think there were, as far as I know, any doves in the Roman Empire at that time who said, this is foolish to fight against these people. Let's just be peaceful and they'll be peaceful too. But we find out in 450 what would have happened a century or more earlier if there had been any large number of such people and if they had been effective in their propaganda. But during this period, there was this constant pressure, and Diocletian got things organized in a very different situation from what they'd been before. Now, many of the things Diocletian introduced may have not been good. In the large perspective, they perhaps were not good. But in the immediate situation, perhaps they were necessary. One thing was he tried to do away with the constant changes of emperorship by removing the emperor from such close contact with the soldiers and with the people. He made him more like an oriental monarch with all sorts of form and ceremony to come near him and thus to make it harder for him to be assassinated and to make his power be more permanent and durable, he thought. He tried various economic expedients, some of which temporarily helped, but some of which may in the end have been harmful. We noticed one thing he introduced, a system which perhaps if it had had a century and a half to get underway might have been effective, but which didn't get well enough started to really give it a fair test. And that was his system of dividing the empire into four parts, with two Augustuses in charge, and then two Caesars under the two Augustuses. And these four, each of them having a fourth of the empire to control, each Caesar under one Augustus, and then the other Augustus really under Diocletian, with his general oversight. It was a system which, perhaps if it had been able to be established for a century or so, might have proved durable. But as it was, it collapsed as soon as Diocletian's strong hand was gone from it. It's too bad, with all the things that Diocletian did to try to administer the empire well and to establish stability, it's too bad that his name should have to be connected with the greatest persecution in the history of the Christian church. But this persecution perhaps amounted to as much as all the previous ones put together. So the persecution of Diocletian then, which is B here, we'll call number one the outbreak of persecution. And the outbreak of persecution was something that could hardly have been expected. For 40 years there had been no persecution. They were large churches in many parts of the empire, great numbers of people attending regularly. Diocletian's own wife and daughter were professing Christians. He had established his capital city at a place called Nicomedia in Asia Minor, a place which was not later of any great importance. Seems to have been a rather important town at that time. And in this place of Nicomedia, he had his great palace, and right across the street from it was a large church. And his wife and his daughter were regular attendants and professing Christians. And the bishop of the church was considered as having very great influence in the city of Nicomedia, and many of his leading officials were Christians. But the Caesar, who was in charge of a fourth of the empire, who was directly under Diocletian, and who consequently had married Diocletian's daughter — each Caesar was supposed to marry a daughter of an Augustus — Galerius, his name was Galerius, G-A-L-E-R-I-U-S. G-A-L-E-R-I-U-S, was seen from all accounts to have been probably the real leader in the persecution. Having been 19 years emperor and never, so far as we know, done anything against Christianity during that time, now in the 20th year of Diocletian's reign, this great persecution breaks out, which is always called the persecution of Diocletian, and which could not have occurred if Diocletian had refused to do it, of course. But Galerius would seem to be the real force back of it. And Galerius was determined to destroy Christianity. It was not, like Nero's case, an attempt simply to make the Christians scapegoats for something. It was not, as in the case of some of the others, simply a rather thoughtless attempt to injure Christians. Nor was it, like in Trajan's case, an attempt simply to say, well, here's the law, enforce it when necessary, but don't make any special effort. This was like Decius and Valerian, a deliberate effort to destroy Christianity. And so the first edict that was made, the edict in 304, was an edict which Diocletian said there should be nobody killed. There should be no killings of any Christians. Nothing like that was to happen, but he agreed that Christianity should be brought to an end. All churches were to be abolished. This I said 304, it was a little early, 303. All churches were to be destroyed. All Christians' writings were to be burnt. And people who professed Christianity were to be declared incapable of holding rank and property, and free men to be degraded to the position of slaves. Well, you can see how far-reaching this is. It was to reduce Christians to be absolutely have no influence, no power in the empire, and for the first time, it deliberately attempted to destroy their right teams. It recognized thus the place that the Bible had in the life of Christianity, and felt that if you could destroy the Bible, that could put an end to Christianity. And so this edict was posted, and a Christian in Nicomedia, seeing this edict, and after 40 years of all freedom from persecution, he simply tore the thing down. And now he was punished not as a Christian, but as one who defied the emperor's orders. He was roasted slowly to death over a slow fire and died with terrible tortures. And he was the first of the martyrs of Christianity in this time. And it really was on account of Christianity, but nominally it was for his attitude toward the edict. And then a fire broke out in the palace. Oh, first, about the churches being torn down. It's very dramatic, the account that is given. I don't know whether it represents the imagination 20 years later or whether it is somebody's account of actually what they saw. But it is very dramatic how people looked out from the palace and how they saw the soldiers beginning to tear down the church and tearing down the side walls and setting fire to parts of it, and this great church right across the street torn down under this edict. The emperor's wife and daughter were forced to sacrifice. They were physically compelled to offer a little sacrifice to one of the statues there. Two of the leading officers of the empire were deprived of their position and made slaves. And shortly after, though, this fire broke out, and Galerius said that the Christians must have set fire to the palace. Just as one Christian had torn down the edict, others must have set fire to the palace. Well, whether this was like the burning of the Reichstag by Hitler's men, it's usually believed that Hitler's men did it in order to give Hitler an excuse for destroying democracy in Germany. Whether this is like that or not, we don't know. There's no reason to think the Christians set fire to the palace. It's not impossible that some fanatic might have done it, but it's extremely unlikely. It would seem more likely that Galerius had done it in order to put the blame on the Christians. Perhaps it's equally likely as either of these that it was purely an accident. But at any rate, fire did break out in the palace, and then Galerius declared that it was the Christians who had done it and had them take the slaves and torture them in order to find out who the culprits were. And under the condition of this torture, why people are apt to say most anything. And if they would say that the Christians caused it, the torture might be cut down at least temporarily. And a new edict was issued, and this ordered the arrest of all the clergy. And then there was a third edict said that still further measures were to be taken, and eventually even a fourth edict in April of the next year. And the two Augustuses and the two Caesars were ordered to carry out these edicts against the Christians. Now, in the next year, in 305, Diocletian abdicated, and he made the other Augustus, one whose name would be quite important from the viewpoint of secular history, but not any point you remember simply from the viewpoint of church history, Maximian, the other Augustus, who he had appointed a few years after he had become emperor. He was required by Diocletian also to abdicate, because that was his system, that at the same time the two Augustuses would abdicate, and the two men who were Caesars would become Augustuses. And then they were supposed to select two men, each of them select a man of great competence, going back to the excellent system of two centuries before, you remember, that is, two men of great competence to become Caesar. But, and so Diocletian abdicated and retired, but instead of his system working out now, it wasn't well enough established to work out, perhaps it wouldn't have anyway. But Galerius immediately determined to get some of his own friends into these positions and to break the system that Diocletian had established. And so during the next 10 or 15 years, with varying upheavals, you have considerable political instability in the empire. But during this time, the persecution was being carried on until 311, with varying force in various parts of the empire, most severely in the area where Galerius was ruling in the east. There it was very, very severe. Now, the area in which it was least severe was the area of France and Britain. France, Spain, and Britain. There it was much less severe than elsewhere because the man who was the Caesar in that area and who was supposed to become Augustus as soon as Maximian had abdicated, Constantius Chlorus, he's called Constantius, C-O-N-S-T-A-N-T-I-U-S. And Chlorus was a nickname given him, which means pale, the pale Constantius, C-H-L-O-R-U-S. Constantius Chlorus there was under orders and carried them out, but only as much as was necessary not to come into conflict with the others. A good many churches were destroyed. Some people were imprisoned. There were a few killings, but not many in Britain, Spain, and France at this particular time. The other parts of the empire varied between the extreme severity of Galerius and the comparative mildness of Constantius Chlorus, and then they were in between with periods when the persecution would be very intense. So much number one, then, the outbreak of persecution. Number two, the new lapsed. The new lapsed. Yes?
Are you going to give us any idea of the cause, the reason behind the persecution? I mean, why did Galerius want to force this and so forth?
We have no evidence. There, some say Galerius was a brutal pagan who hated Christians. Others say he was an ambitious man who wanted to get complete control and saw the Christians as an obstacle in his way. Others say he was like Diocletian, one who wanted to establish a unified empire, and he saw the tightly knit together Christians as a state within a state that was an obstacle to real progress. Depends on your viewpoint. If we could have a few hours of interview with Galerius, maybe we could find out what really was in his mind. But we can't. And we don't know what was in his mind altogether. Probably all these things entered in to some extent. But of course, the one man alone couldn't do it. Doubtless, it was the argument about the stability of the state that he used to convince Diocletian. That is our general impression of his excellent rule before it would lead us to think so. But whatever the cause, it was a carefully worked out plan, like Decius had, only Decius' plan ended because of his death within 2 years. It was a carefully worked out plan, and the plan which aimed to get, not merely to kill a few Christians, but to get at the root of the matter, to get rid of their officers, to get rid of their books, which hadn't been in mind before. And so we have the new lapsed, naturally. This was a problem under Decius and Valerian. Now again it becomes a problem. Once the persecution gets underway, you have a great many people who had been attending the church because it gave them a standing in the society, or because they thought these Christians were nice people and they liked to be associated with them, because they felt that honesty was the best policy and it was good to give their support to it, or for some other such reason, without any very deep feeling, who immediately rushed to sacrifice. And you have some probably who were sincere Christians, but who were lacking in courage, who began to rationalize and try to find excuses for going through some form that would free them from this, or thinking they could continue as secret Christians or something like that. But you have quite a number of the lapsed as you had before, and also you have people who hadn't been thought of as very strong Christians who immediately proved to be very brave in their stand for their convictions. You have many surprises in the way people react in situations like this. But you have now a new type of lapsed people that you hadn't had before. And that is because of the order that the Christian books are to be destroyed. And consequently, there came into existence a group of people whom the Christians in after years called traditores. Now, a traditor is a Latin word that means one who hands it over. It's one who handed over the books. Now, there were Christians who, when the soldiers would come and say, let's have the Christian books, would hand them some account books or some fairy stories or something like that and say, here they are. And I don't think they were very much looked down on by other Christians for doing that. But if they did that and tried to hide the Bible or tried to protect it in some way or simply refused to turn it over, they were considered as confessors, considered as brave, loyal Christians. But there were those who, in order to save their own skins, turned over the copies of the Bible, which were then taken and destroyed. I shouldn't say of the Bible, because the Bible was not yet in one volume. It would be maybe 40 separate scrolls. And they turned over such of these scrolls as were available, and people called them traditors. And if anybody could be looked on 20 years, 30 years later as having been a traditor in the time of the persecution, that was would make people greatly dislike him and look down on him in the Christian church, naturally, the traditors. And so you have this, these traditors, and you have the people who denied the faith, but then you have a great many who courageously declared it, particularly young people. There were many young people who went out and said, well, you've killed my father. Here, I'm just as strong a Christian as he is. You must kill me too. There were a great many who went and practically threw themselves in front of the persecutors. But this persecution lasted longer than any other of which we have evidence. It was carried on very strongly for a period of about 8 years, and to some extent in some areas for another 10 years after that, though not so much. But for nearly 8 years, the persecution was very severe. Number three is the death of Galerius. The death of Galerius. Galerius, in 311, was taken with a very bad disease. And they say it was like what Herod had, we read about in the book of Acts. A very loathsome disease of his abdomen, which made it very disagreeable for people to be near him, and which gave him tremendous pain and misery. And he decided to call off the persecution. And so in 311, he issued an edict of toleration. He got two other of the leaders of the empire to sign it with him, but it very clearly was his work. He said that the cause of the persecution had been the division of the Christians into factions, fighting one another, their refusal to follow the good customs of their fathers, and gave various statements like this. And then he said, however, many people had suffered greatly in the persecution. They felt now it had accomplished its purpose, and so the emperors in their clemency were going to allow the religion of Christ to be practiced again and churches to be rebuilt. And then he called upon the Christians to pray for him and remember him in their prayers, and to pray for the welfare of the empire. Now, of course, most consider this as either entirely hypocritical or as simply the expression of his agony and pain in his suffering, and looking for any straw that could give him relief. Whatever the situation, the persecution in its greatest phases was brought to an end by this edict of 311, the death of Galerius and his edict in 311. Well, number four, we'll call the rise of Constantine. The rise of Constantine. It would take me half an hour to make clear to you the political changes during this period of upheaval, these 6 or 7 years, and you probably wouldn't remember them half an hour later. So I will not go into them in detail, just to mention that this was a time when Galerius was trying to get certain of his own friends into the leadership in the empire. And when some of the men whom Diocletian had picked to lead on proved to be just as bad in their personal ambition and character as Galerius too. Diocletian's plan fell to pieces because the men in leadership in it were men who were looking out for their own advantage rather than trying to carry on something for the well-being of the empire. And so there was a great deal of fighting among themselves and scheming and changing situations. And in the midst of this, a young man came to the fore in a way that must have taken tremendous planning on his part, very great activity, and a very brilliant scheme, and also very able generalship. This man has been known ever since in history as Constantine the Great. We will give a whole section to him a little later. Now we're merely looking at his rise. But he fully deserves the term the Great after his name. In the Eastern Church, the Greek Orthodox Church, I believe to this day he is considered a saint and called Saint Constantine. The Western Church has never called him a saint. But both areas have recognized him as well-deserving the name the Great. Now I mentioned Constantius Chlorus to you. Constantius Chlorus had been an able warrior in the previous century, and then had been the ruler of a section of what is now Yugoslavia, a section which he ruled very wisely and prudently and with great moderation. And so Diocletian had made a good selection in making Constantius Chlorus the Caesar over the part of the empire furthest removed from Diocletian's headquarters in Asia Minor. Well, Constantius Chlorus had a son whom he named Constantine. But Constantine, when he was just a young boy, was taken to the east to be in Diocletian's palace, to be brought up in the palace of Diocletian, perhaps to quite an extent really as a hostage for the dependability of his father. And so the young boy brought up amid the plots and schemes of the palace there, had to learn to live very cautiously in order to survive, and to wondering when he could get back to his father again, and whether he would ever have a chance to amount to anything in the empire, and evidently was learning a great deal from observing the situation right there in the nerve center of the empire. And then when Diocletian abdicated, Constantine was with Galerius, but he decided that he would probably fall into great danger with Galerius, and he found an excuse to get away from him and head off to join his father in the west. And especially as he saw that Galerius was planning to get rid of Constantius Chlorus and to get one of his own cronies in his place. And of course, automatically, Constantius Chlorus had become an Augustus when the two older ones had abdicated. He had become an Augustus, but Galerius was hoping to get rid of him and get two new men there in his place. According to what we can learn, Constantine got away on some excuse and made his way as fast as he could across Europe to join his father in France. And there's one variation of the story says that at each post house where he took a horse, that in some way he got rid of all the other horses so nobody could get horses to pursue him with. One story says he took the other horses with him in every place. I would think he'd have quite a mob of horses before he got there at that rate. But at any rate, he seems to have been able to get clear across to France and join his father. And then his father had to go to Britain, where the wild Picts and Scots of the north, who had never been conquered by the Romans, were making an attack into the Roman territory. And Constantius had to go there to drive them off from England into northern Britain. And only a few months Constantine had been with his father when his father suddenly died. And immediately they were at the place called York in northern England. They were there, the army was, when Constantius Chlorus died, and immediately the soldiers declared that the young man Constantine should be the new Augustus to take his father's place. And Constantine wrote a very nice letter to Galerius explaining how he'd had nothing to do with this. This was the soldiers who had declared and called out that he was to be the new Augustus, and that under the circumstances life would be in danger if he didn't go along with the soldiers, but he hoped to work everything out in proper form and so on. But in 306, this way, he was declared Augustus by the soldiers, and Galerius would write nice letters to him, but he knew Galerius was scheming to get rid of him. And so for the next 5 years, Constantine had a rather difficult way to get along in holding his power and, in fact, increasing it. And then after Galerius died, then the son of the former Augustus of the West tried to get control in the West. But Constantine felt that he was now, after 5 years of carrying on his father's position, he was entitled to be the Augustus of the West, and so you have nearly 2 years of maneuvering and fighting between these two men. And then in 312, Constantine had defeated enough of Maxentius' forces that he with his army was down in Italy, and Maxentius was in Rome. Maxentius had a far greater army and was an older man, a more experienced man, but Constantine had had many victories. He was very cautious, watched his chance, and then struck with determination. And Maxentius didn't know whether he should go out and attack Constantine or whether he should wait behind the strong walls of Rome until Constantine's forces would be weakened and then make an attack on him. And so he asked the keepers of the Sibylline books. There were in Rome at this time some books they called the Sibylline books. According to the legend, these books had been held by the keepers of the Sibylline books for centuries. They said that one of the early rulers of Rome, that a woman came to him and offered him 9 books, which he said contained all the mysteries of the future and told what to do in every conceivable situation. And that she offered them to him for a large sum, and he laughed at her. So she went away, and the next day she came back, said she destroyed 3 of the books. She'd offer him the 6th of them. And she offered them at the same price as the 9 before. Again, he laughed at her. So the next day she came back and said she'd destroyed 3 more. Now she had only 3 left, and she offered them for the same price as the original 9, and he bought them. That's the story. Well, at any rate, whatever their origin, it's pretty well established that Maxentius asked the officials who were keepers of the Sibylline books to look into them and to tell him what he should do. Should he march out with his army and attack Constantine, or should he wait and be behind the walls of Rome? And the answer was given, if you march out and attack Constantine, the enemy of Rome will perish. And of course, that would be a wonderful victory for him, so he marched out. And the two armies met, and Maxentius' forces were defeated, he himself was drowned. Constantine was thus proven to be the true enemy, and Maxentius the enemy of Rome. So he perished just as the keepers of the books had said, the enemy of Rome would perish. But there is a story which was told 20 years later that not long before this, Constantine had seen a flaming cross in the sky at noontime with big letters under it in Latin, "By this sign conquer," and that Constantine had then decided to go for Christianity and attack Maxentius. According to one form of the story, it was a vision of Constantine. According to another, all the soldiers had seen it. And whether you think that Constantine was now fully interested in Christianity or whether you think he was using it as a means of advancing his own power depends partly on your judgment of Constantine. And at this time, my guess would be that the emotions were mixed in him. At any rate, Constantine, previous to this, had acted with great caution at every step. And in the last stages of this conflict with Maxentius, he had moved with boldness, which previously had not been characteristic of him. Something had happened, at least, whether he thought it was a wise thing to proceed with a boldness different from before, or what, or whether he did have such a vision that had affected him. The fact is that he did. And he now was in complete control of the eastern part of the empire, of the western part of the empire. And so in number 5 here is the Edict of 313. In 313, 2 years after the Edict of Galerius, Constantine and the man named Licinius, who was now had gained the strength in the east, he jointly issued a declaration. And this edict of 313 gave more toleration to the Christians than the previous one had. Galerius had said in 311, and Constantine Licinius joined with him in it. Now these two said in 313 that Christians were not to be subject to any restrictions. They were to be free to carry on their worship unhindered. And it went beyond the Edict of 311 and is usually considered as the great Edict of Toleration of the Church, the Edict of 313. Actually, they had been given toleration by Gallienus 60 years before, if you remember. But it was after 40 years of no persecution that this greatest of all persecutions had broken out. This, however, was the end of any great national persecution in the Roman Empire of Christianity, was this Edict of 313. However, number six. Six is Licinius, L-I-C-I-N-I-U-S. Licinius continues persecution in the East. Licinius continues persecution in the East to 323. Now, Licinius had control in the East and Constantine in the West. But Constantine gradually gained control over more of the East until in the latter of these years, Licinius had maybe a third of the empire. And then in 323, there was a final war between him and Constantine in which Constantine was completely victorious. And so from 324 on, Constantine has the whole empire entirely under his control. And Licinius would not seem to have been one who had a great objective of destroying the Christian church. But as the opposition between him and Constantine became more intense, and Constantine was declaring himself a protector of the Christians, Licinius declared himself a protector of the pagans. And he did a certain amount of persecution, particularly toward the end of his reign, so that the persecution in the East actually continued for nearly 20 years. So the first eight were by far the worst part. In the West, it continued about 8 years altogether. And this persecution resulted in the destruction of a great many Christians, and particularly a great many Christian leaders, the destruction of many Christian books, probably some writings that would be very valuable if we had them, are completely lost. But the copies of the Bible, while some were destroyed, enough were hidden or carefully kept so that there was no loss to our knowledge of the Bible through the persecution. Now, number seven, we will call a schism in Egypt. Schism in Egypt. In Egypt, during the persecution, there came a division, just as there had been a division in Africa 60 years before in the Dacian persecution. Now, this division in Egypt came because the disputes over the treatment of the lapsed and many bishops in prison unable to administer their affairs. There was a bishop in southern Egypt who felt that he should step in and that he should endeavor to fill up the broken ranks. And he took a leadership which others did not feel that he was entitled to. And so this man, whose name was Meletius, M-E-L-E-T-I-U-S, after him it's called the Meletian Schism in Egypt. The result was that when the persecution was over, there was many a town in Egypt that had two bishops, each of them having people following him, and a group of these bishops being those who had been appointed by militia, while the others claimed to be connected with the main church of Egypt. And this schism in Egypt was something which many felt something must be done about, something must be done to remedy it. More serious than the Meletian schism is number eight. Number eight was the schism in North Africa. And here in North Africa, there had been the same problems during the persecution as occurred during the time of Cyprus. The persecution here in North Africa had taken a great many of the leaders. The bishop there had hidden, as Cyprian did during the persecution under Decian. He felt that he could do more good to the church by directing it from hiding than by giving his life at this time. And he would seem to have been able to accomplish a great deal in preserving the church. But there were those who were very, very critical of him. And there were in North Africa the very strong dispute, such as there had been in the time of Cyprian. And so the result was that after the persecution was over, when the bishop died and his archdeacon was elected bishop to succeed him, there was a large group which refused to recognize him as bishop, and they formed a separate group, and they had groups all over North Africa that joined with them. And this schism lasted for at least a century, maybe for two centuries. These people were called Donatists, D-O-N-A-T-I-S-T-S. It's rather interesting. They would be called Donatists when we think of Novatus, the leader of the schism against Cyprian before, that only lasted a very brief time. But these Donatists were a separate church in Egypt, in North Africa, for at least a century, and possibly for two after this. There was absolutely no doctrinal difference between the Donatists and the Catholics. But the Donatists may have taken as many as a fourth or a third of the Christians in North Africa. They had many bishops, and when we come to St. Augustine a century later, a great part of his life activity consists of his relation with the Donatists. So it's important to notice their formation at this time. D-O-N-A-T-I-S-T, the Donatists, yes? Well, 50 years later, 60 years later. I don't know whether, I don't know how many there may have been in between. I don't think one was in there 60 years. It was probably two or three later. But it was the in the line from Cyprian, yes. They declared that the Catholics had been too lenient with the last. It was just the opposite to the situation with Cyprian. They claimed Cyprian had been too severe. The Donatists claimed he'd been too lenient. And they claimed that Cecilian, the man who became the new bishop in Carthage after the persecution, that Cecilian didn't have proper respect for the confessors and for the martyrs. The confessors sometimes would give complete forgiveness to all the lasts. You remember in the time of Cyprian, some of them did this now, and the bishop thought that they should examine each case on its merit. And they recognized there were some cases of alleged martyrs or confessors who really were criminals, who were seizing this as an excuse for avoiding the punishment that should have come to them for their evil, and who now were claiming to be great heroes because of having been confessors. They were trying to judge each case on its merit, and that's what they wanted to do, while the others, the Donatists, felt that they didn't give proper respect to the confessors and the martyrs. And when Cecilian became the new bishop of North Africa, the man who presided at his installation, a man named Felix from another town in North Africa, the Donatists said had been a traditor in the persecution. They said, therefore, his installation was not legal because this man was a traditor who installed it. Well, there was very sharp controversy for over a century about the details of this schism in North Africa. As soon as everything was satisfactorily established under Constantine and the Empire, the Donatists sent to Constantine and asked him, at least so it is claimed, and asked Constantine to give them their rightful position as the church in North Africa. And Constantine got a group of Christian leaders in France and Italy to go and investigate, and these men came back and said Cecilian and the others were the proper leaders of the church in North Africa. And so Constantine said, well, now, you folks are wrong. You should be subject to them. Turn over to them control of your churches, And then the Donna said, what is the church to do with the empire? What right does the empire have to interfere in our affairs? And at least their enemies claimed that they were thus inconsistent in their attitude. Now, of course, everything we have is from the other side, from the one side. So we don't know the full story. But that is what they claimed was the attitude of the Donatists. At least from this time on, then, the Donatists claimed that they should be free from imperial interference. Well, we thus see how every situation in this world in which there is no one is perfect, everyone is sinful, everyone has weaknesses, and no one is completely sanctified, situations are not altogether black and white. They're always mixed. And it's often hard to get the exact full picture. But the persecution purified the church, it cleansed the church, it proved to the Roman world that Christianity was now so large and so well entrenched that you couldn't destroy Christianity without destroying the empire, actually. It proved that, and it brought an end to the efforts to destroy the church for the well-being of the empire. It did not end with Christianity being made the state religion. That is a false idea many people have. Constantine did not make Christianity the state religion. His edict declared that every person should decide for himself what religion he wished to follow. He put Christianity in a privileged position, but not in a supreme position. The pagan rites and ceremonies still had their place in many aspects of government. Many pagans were in very important positions, and they were not discriminated against on account of their religion. Constantine put Christianity in a privileged position, but not in a supreme position in the empire. Very soon, he found new problems to meet, such as he had never suspected. And those we look at tomorrow.